Well, good morning, everyone, from the Providence Academy Adult Bible Study. Used to be the Mom's Bible Study, but in an inclusive age, you don't just restrict it. Yeah, don't just restrict it to the moms. So my name is Arthur Hippler. For those of you who don't know me, I've been at Providence. I'm now starting my 16th year. So I came here the year that they built the high school wing, and I've enjoyed it immensely. I mostly teach, well, I teach sophomores every year. I always have all the sophomores, and then sometimes I will have seniors, sometimes I will have juniors. Right now I'm teaching two elective classes, the philosophy, which is one semester, and the political ideas, which is a political philosophy in the spring. I enjoy it immensely. I especially enjoy teaching the sophomores. They're right at the age where you're sort of the ground floor of their intellectual development. They can ask, well, as you know, as middle schoolers and ninth graders, they can ask all sorts of hard questions, but you try to give them adult answers and they just stare at you. Whereas 10th grade, you can start to give them adult answers and they get it. The wheels are starting to turn in that direction. So that's enormously satisfying. I have been teaching the Bible study now since, I'm looking at Mrs. Cummins because I want to say 2013 or 2014. So I've been here a while. My background, my doctorate is in philosophy from Boston College. But most of my career, I've been teaching theology, either dogmatic theology, so God attributes and all that, or moral theology. And in fact, I regularly teach over at St. Paul School of Divinity. I teach graduate courses over there in theology. So theology is mostly what I've been doing. And even when I was working on philosophy, a lot of that was St. Thomas, and that's what I got out of college. So my entrance into Bible study and scripture study tends to be through the church fathers and the church doctors. And as you will hear, I'm fairly critical of a lot of what's been going on in biblical scholarship in I would say not just like since the 60s, we always like to pick on things since the 60s, but really things that have been going on, I would say, for the last 150 years. And really come out of the German liberal Protestant move to historicize the Bible, to desupernaturalize the Bible, to simply remove the supernatural character of the Bible and turn it into a cultural artifact, to turn it into an inspirational text, a moral text, a political text, anything but an inspired, revelatory entrance into a world beyond the world in which we live and move. In other words, a world that really, truly unites us with a supernatural being who is our author and end. So I'm going to a presupposition of this course is that there really is a God who reveals himself in history. There really is a personal God who reveals himself in history, that works miracles, that speaks to individuals in their historical setting, but is giving them things above and beyond what we as human beings would figure out on our own. That even when he speaks to them through their cultural circumstances, what he's revealing to them is sort of above and beyond what that culture would get you all on its own. And I would say that's not just true of Revelation. When you look at people who really are great thinkers and writers, a Homer, a Plato, a Shakespeare, they are not just like the sum total of whatever was going on in that culture. They really sort of blow the doors off of what it is that culture was doing up to that point. So even from the point of view of human genius, you're not just getting cultural expressions, or we're not just doing anthropology. The final thing I think that would be helpful for you to understand about me and why I'm at the front of the room or why this is something that would be important to me. My upbringing was not a religious upbringing. My father grew up Catholic, but he fell away from the faith in college, and he was out of the church for the next 30 years. My father received his bachelor degree and his doctorate in anthropology from the University of California, Berkeley, in the 60s, with everything that that implies. With everything that that implies. And so, you know, I don't have time to elaborate or unfold upon it now, but I came to the faith basically through reading and study as a junior in high school. So I came into the church as a 17-year-old. Sadly, as I was coming in, most of the kids that were Catholic that I was going to school with were on their way out. In fact, they were getting confirmed and leaving. They would describe confirmation as their graduation ceremony from the church. They were very open about it. By the way, I remember talking to a Lutheran pastor who told me, this is a Lutheran joke, okay? That, but it applies to, sadly, to Catholics as well. They've got bats in the belfry of this Lutheran church, and they get exterminators, they try high-pitched noises, nothing works. Finally, the bishop comes and he confirms all the bats, and they never see them again. Okay? And I laughed when I heard that, because unfortunately, you know, that can be true in the Catholic world as well. Things are tough all over. Okay? So we are beginning an exploration for a whole year of the Gospel of Luke. And each gospel has its, you know, I suppose you could, what's your favorite gospel? I mean, the tough thing about a question like that is each gospel really does have its own character. It's, in a way, almost its own message, its own traits. And I must admit, there are things about John that I really like. John was the first gospel that we did together in the Bible study. Now, what was that, 6-7 years ago? But Luke is something that I've really been looking forward to, because there are so many unique traits about Luke. There are so many stories in it that are not in other gospels. So there's a way in which among the synoptic gospels, in other words, Matthew, Mark, Luke is giving you things that Mark and Matthew do not, even though he's covering a lot of the same turf that Matthew and Mark are. You know, John is very different because he really is interested in filling out all sorts of things. He comes much later, and he really is filling out all sorts of things that the earlier three didn't. But, you know, it's in Luke that you get the prodigal son, that you get the rich man and Lazarus. There's so many, that you get the infancy narratives at the beginning. There's so many things that you get out of that Luke that you don't get in Matthew and Mark. So what I'd like to do today, this is one of the great things about, you know, I get my marker board back. When we were in the, not only was that being in the pack, you know, you always feel as though you're, you know, you should be singing instead of lecturing. But you don't, this is helpful. I need things to help me stay on track. You know, this is what I do when I'm teaching 16-year-olds. I have a little map up there so that I don't get off on bunny trails. I need to be kept in line. I need to be directed. And so I'm very happy to have this back. So what I wanted to do is just, you know, say some introductory things. There are going to be a number of things that in your resource there, it will talk about. And I don't just want to talk about things that are there. I don't want to repeat what's there. I want to try to add to what it is you would get out of your Ignatius Press. I should note, these are available for sale. 18. I accidentally ordered a bunch of them, not realizing this was just a New Testament. You know, for our students, we get them the whole Bible. You know, they get a Bible, all new students get them, and then our upcoming students when they're in the sixth grade. So they have a Bible that they're year to year. This is the first year I did the Bible study, and so, of course, it was a disaster. there are administrative things that I'm still working on. But our loss is your gain, because especially... one of the things that Mrs. Cummins and I have talked about, if next year, for example, we did a bunch of the smaller letters, so if we did James, Jude, maybe Philemon from St. Paul, letters of John, that way it'd be one-stop shopping. You wouldn't have to have all these little booklets for each of them. We could do it in one volume. I just think there are a lot of...
Doesn't
It doesn't have the questions. There are ways to that I think we could make questions available. But in terms of the important things, the commentary and the notes and so on, that's the essential thing. So first, let's talk a little bit about one of the characteristics just from who Luke is. Luke is a physician. He's a doctor, and he's the patron of doctors. And there are all sorts of ways in the gospel in which that's evident. So this isn't something where we have some kind of pious tradition, but who knows if it's true or not. No, you can see it all through the gospel that this is somebody who has medical knowledge and uses medical terms. So for example, when it talks about, I think this is St. Peter's mother-in-law, and talks about her having a fever. The other gospel writers will say she has a fever, but he will use this term that she had a great fever. So in other words, that this was a very high temperature, it was long-lasting. He's interested in details. Okay. The lepers who come, you are told, for example, in Matthew, that there are these men who come who had leprosy. But he, Luke, will talk about a great state of leprosy. In other words, that this was long term, that this was somebody whose leprosy was far advanced. When you're a physician, you just pick that up. That's something that's interesting to you, in a way that for a lot of other people we don't make those kind of distinctions. It's Luke who notices that the Gadarene demoniac is not wearing clothes. In fact, his description tends to be a little more detailed. Again, the way that you might be if you were looking at a patient and you were saying they have the following symptoms or presentations. When we have the woman who has the hemorrhage for 12 years, Luke uses this term that the blood was staunched. Again, a lot of the other gospel writers would just talk about it stopping or ceasing. But he uses a term like you would use if you were a physician and you were talking about the using a technical term to say the blood flow ended. Finally, to me, one of the more revealing passages, and again, so unique in Luke, in the agony in the garden, when Jesus sweats, and remember, there are, in most translations, it will say drops of blood. When you look at the Greek word is thromboi, like thrombosis. So if you were to translate it literally, it would be clots of blood. It would be clots of blood. And in fact, Luke is describing something that is a very rare but real physical condition. You can have people who, under great stress, what will happen is the capillaries will burst and seep into the sweat glands. And what's happening is once that blood in the sweat glands hits the air, it clots. So when you talk about Jesus sweating drops of blood, no, he has these little blood clots that are coming out of his sweat glands. I think the condition is called hematidrosis. And the only reason I know about it is from this little book, A Doctor at Calvary, by Barbet, B-A-R-B-E-T. He was a French doctor who went through the Gospels and talks about, point by point, Jesus' death from a medical point of view. What did he die of? He uses the text of the Gospel, but he also uses the Shroud of Turin. He was the one, it was Barbet, who figured out by working on cadavers that if you put the nail where it belongs in the wrist, the thumb folds over. So when you look at the Shroud of Turin, you can't see thumbs. When you look at artistic representations, they're always putting the nail in the palm. And they may make sense artistically, but there's nothing to hold there. At the risk of being graphic, if you're going to hold somebody, you got to do it in the bones. You got to do it right about here. But what happens is you hit this tendon that causes the thumb to fold over. And when you look in the Shroud of Turin, there are no thumbs. And that's the kind of thing that Barbet, as a physician and somebody looking at this, what kind of genius produces a fraud like that? You have to really understand human anatomy. Anybody else, would have put in the thumbs, because they would have been following the artistic design that you see on crucifixes and you see in pictures. You would have to fool around with bodies to know that that thumb folds over the way it does. So those are the kinds of things that simply argue against the shroud being a forgery. Okay? In any event, these are just five. There are more. There are all sorts of ways in which Luke is giving detail, especially physical medical detail, and using terms that are medical terms, terms that you would find in Galen, who is the kind of standard reading for physicians, that you don't find them in the other Gospels. This is a man, in other words, with a technical knowledge of medicine. Okay? And I'll highlight that as we go through. Let's look at the opening. If you look at the opening sentence, or opening paragraph, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. Okay? Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished. So when Luke is writing this, you have some idea that whether orally or in some kind of written account, there are things floating around out there about Jesus. Okay? So there are, in other words, there are many who have done this. And that could be an awareness not so much of Matthew or Mark. It could be other things that are out there that now we no longer know about. They're not there. But Luke, Matthew, Mark, these survived in a way that those things didn't, because they gave more or more of the truth of what was happening. And one of the commentaries that I will make frequent use of, Alfred Plummer. Let me put that name down for you. Alfred Plummer is an Anglican of the early first half of the 20th century. So his commentary on Luke, it's one of these things that you can find if you go to archive.org, you know, these places. It's probably in Google Books. But Alfred Plummer's commentary on the Gospel of Luke, I'm going to say it's like 1912 or whatnot. But the thing that can be a little difficult about Plummer is he is commenting on the Greek. So there'll be all sorts of Greek, you know, phrases from the Gospel. But if you don't get spooked by the sight of Greek, Plummer can be helpful. And Plummer will talk about how it is in this very opening paragraph, he is giving you distinctive traits about this Gospel. In this very opening paragraph. So notice this expression, from the beginning. And these are the Greek terms here. Anothen, pasin, akribos, kathexis. But from the beginning. In other words, I'm giving you something that I'm trying as much as possible, you know, to put the whole thing in. But following all things, pasin, that you are, it's going to be complete. So I'm giving it from the beginning, I'm giving it in a comprehensive way, I'm giving you it complete. Some translations, in our translation it says closely. Other translations you'll see thoroughly. Akribos, when I run into this word in Aristotle, it usually means accurately. So I'm giving you something from the beginning, all the details, I'm vouching for the accuracy. And this is the other Gospels, they're going to have that to various degrees. Mark doesn't start from the beginning. Remember, Mark starts with John the Baptist. Matthew starts from the beginning. But this orderly account, kathexis, Luke is the only Gospel which appears to really care about chronological narrative. When you read Matthew and Mark, they care to some degree about chronology, but they will move events around. Because especially with Matthew, Matthew is more thematic. By thematic, if you think about Matthew, Matthew alternates between sermons and action. So for example, at the beginning, you have, let's say, the preaching, you have the temptation of the desert, Matthew 4, and then 5, 6, 7, that's the Sermon on the Mount. And then there's more action, and then you have a whole string of parables. So Matthew cares more about whether the action and the speaking are and the preaching are complementing each other than he cares about whether this is happening year one, year two, year three. Okay? Whereas Luke is somebody who cares more about he did this, then that. So as a modern reader, this is something that we like. Okay? It drives us crazy when we aren't getting things in sequence. Okay? It could be like you're like my wife in this respect. When she watches a movie, and let's say it's one of these mystery thrillers in which there is a lot of kind of backstory and flashbacks. Oh, how my wife hates flashbacks. Flashbacks would be abolished from film if my wife had her way. She wants to start at the beginning and work her way through. And but of course, the problem is in narrative, you watch yourself doing this. You do not necessarily, even when you tell stories about like the Labor Day weekend and the weekend at the cabin or whatnot, you don't necessarily hour one, hour three. You hop back and forth because you hop back and forth according to what you think your hearer is interested in, what the relevant information. So you insert things that really are, in a way, like flashbacks, because you don't want to burden your listener with all sorts of, you know, backstory, and they're trying to see like the point, right? You do that judiciously. And you have to understand that biblical narratives work the same way. They aren't necessarily chronological because they're giving you what you need to understand this or that point, which doesn't necessarily work well chronologically. But Luke, what he has decided is, no, I'm gonna do this from start to finish, so you have a chronological sense of the events. We have two other gospels that have worked thematically. I'm going to give you an orderly account. Go ahead.
I've had people challenge and say, well, why didn't they write it chronologically? Like, how can it be true? Like,
okay, again, for the very...
down and then, like, go back then. Like, okay, you're getting all these ideas, but then...
For the very reason that and any of us in this room do not always tell stories chronologically.
But when you're going to actually write it.
No, even when you tell... If you were to write down the story of my weekend at the lake... You are not necessarily going to tell that story chronologically. You don't. You skip around. And the reason you skip around is because that's what the hearer needs. The hearer doesn't necessarily need all the things given in chronological order. And in fact, the significance of what you're saying could actually be obscured by you telling it in chronological order. Okay? And the second thing, I guess, to point out is that a gospel writer doesn't think that what he's doing is writing, if you like, a history text. It's as if what that person is thinking is, you're writing a textbook in history. And so, of course, in a textbook, you're not going to skip around. It really is going to be the Seven Years' War, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. But textbooks don't have to hold anybody's interest. You follow me? I mean, you don't have to be interested in the teacher stands over you. Here's the assignment. You know, the professor stands over you. Read 100 pages for tomorrow. So textbooks don't have to hold anybody's interest. You have to be very careful, in fact, of just giving a strict chronology and having the student or the reader understand the importance of what you're telling them. In a textbook, it doesn't matter. Because you have a captive audience, so there are things where it can work. So it's not impossible to do that. You know, that's what I'm saying that Luke is doing here. But it could be that what Matthew intends to convey is better served by him moving around, and what Luke intends to convey is better served by him moving in an orderly way. That's why you can't abstract how you're communicating from what you're communicating. And if you are just locked in to know everything has to be communicated this way, that means there are all sorts of things that are worth communicating that now can't be communicated. There have to be ways. Just think of the difference between movies and books. Okay, you can have great books and lousy movies. That's not the comparison I'm making. But half of what makes Dickens work is his descriptions. So you can't capture that in a movie. Any movie about Dickens is giving you 40 to 50% of the book. Because the power of Dickens is the power of the narrative and the power of the caricature. You can sort of do that in film, but it's harder. Likewise, if you're taking a great movie director, so Akira Kurosawa or Rossellini or Ingmar Bergman, you can't make a novel out of Bergman's The Seventh Seal. The Seventh Seal works the way it does because of the images. So if it really, you know, different media are able to convey different things. And at the point where, no, it has to be, books are boring, it has to be a movie. Okay, everything that's conveyed by narration is gone. No, I don't like movies. Books are it. Truly culture people only. Films should have never been invented. Okay. All the imagery that makes a narrative powerful in a great movie. Okay, that's all closed for you. Anyway, but it's just narrow is the problem. They have a narrowness. They want it to fit a rigid scheme or nothing. Okay, let us move real quick over here. Why am I giving this to you? Last line, that you may know thoroughly. And that word for know thoroughly, epignos. So, gnos, or you may be familiar from this heresy, Gnosticism. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. And Gnosticism was this heresy that there are just these things you know that save you. It's not that you do things or believe things. No, there's just these things you know. But here, epignos, that you know thoroughly. That, in other words, there are things that you have to understand, grasp about who Jesus is and what he did that is going to allow your faith to be a full and complete faith. Okay? So I am, like John will say, these things are being conveyed to you that you may believe. Okay? And an important point to make here, that's why I have this gospel historicity. It is important in Christianity that things happen as a matter of historical fact. Not all religions are like that. Not all religions are like that. In Buddhism, it doesn't really matter when and where the Buddha was born. That's not really important in Buddhism. The Buddha has a message. Your job is to understand that message, live that message. It doesn't really matter whether he worked miracles or not. It doesn't really matter what happened to his body after he died. None of those things matter in Buddhism. Okay? There is a certain historical core that matters in Islam, but it's fairly restricted. You know, that Muhammad had a revelation, that his revelation was from God, that the Quran is the infallible expression of that revelation. You know, after that, a lot of it is hadith or commentary, disputes among authorities, but, you know, that basic revelation, that's pretty much what it is to be a Muslim, is to accept that. Okay? Whereas the difference, going back to Judaism, that Moses was a real person, that God spoke to Moses, that he revealed things which were historically true about the creation of the world and what God was like, that there are instructions that the Hebrew people were supposed to live out, that they failed to live out to them, that they got carried off to Babylon and Assyria, that they were in God's providence and mercy, that they were able to return to their own land. And that finally, at a particular point in history, that the Messiah who had been prophesied appeared. Those are all things that are important as matters of historical fact. Because for Jesus to be who he says he is, he has to be pointing to things that foresee or prefigure his coming. If you're going to come to earth as God in a human nature, Well, who says? You know, who says you are who you say you are? And what the Old Testament does is create an enormous paper trail that this person is going to appear. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. He's going to die in Jerusalem. He's going to die by crucifixion. He's going to be betrayed by his friends. He's going to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, right? All of the Old Testament points to the appearance of this historic person. So there are ways that history matters in Christianity in a way that it matters in no other religion. If we go over to mythologies, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, you know, history is not important to that at all. Norse mythology doesn't have things that are historically crucial. But if there aren't real facts behind the Old Testament, then why is it that we should believe that Jesus is who he says he is? Okay. So, for example, that you will have in Luke, chapter 2, in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus to all the world should be enrolled. The first enrollment when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and each went to be enrolled, each to his own city. You know, it is not easy to find other religions that sit there and will identify who's the emperor, who's the local governor, what were they doing as a matter of government policy, an enrollment. Okay. By the way, in my public school, this is I think a testimony to how old I am. In my public school, in the sixth grade, as part of a Christmas pageant in my public school, I had to memorize that paragraph and recite it with my classmates. You know, all of us 12-year-olds. And it came to pass that Caesar Augustus, the census went out to the whole world, right? And they each to his own city. And Joseph went out from Galilee to the city of Nazareth. Okay? And, you know, I was doing some of this memorization at home. And my father, who was a former state president of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, founding state president in the state of Alaska, thought nothing of it. You know, that, well, it's Christmas. What else are they going to do, right? You memorize things for a Christmas pageant. Okay? It really does show you how old I am. And by the way, of course, if you look at the Charlie Brown Christmas special, when Charlie Brown is going, trying to figure out what is Christmas all about. How does that end? With Linus on the stage with this same passage. And it came to pass that Caesar Augustus... No, he was more dignified than that. He has a blanket. And it came to pass that Caesar Augustus, the census of the whole world. Okay. By the way, if you read about the history of that, CBS did not want that in the Charlie Brown Christmas special. They didn't want that. They considered it too religious. And Charles Schulz, to his credit, a Minnesota Lutheran, would not budge. Good. No, that has to be in there. You know, we're not running it. So that, and by the way, I will talk to students here. You'd be amazed how many students have never seen the Charlie Brown Christmas special. Because it's too old. Right? That's like 60 years old out there, or 50 years old. So what I tell them is, stop watching Elf over and over again. Elf is funny, but there really are these other things. Like, you would be surprised how many of them have never seen It's a Wonderful Life. When I ask sophomores, how many of you have seen It's a Wonderful Life? It's usually like two or three in a room of 26. So that's the other time. Okay, Elf is funny. Nothing against Elf. Discover other things. You know? Discover other things. Okay. So I brought that up because that you give the governor, that you give the, you know, the emperor, that you give, in other words, historical context and historical reality is important for the Gospels. It matters. The audience here in Greek, Kratiste Theophile, right? Most powerful, most noble. Theophilus. That could indicate the status of this guy. This is a guy who evidently has some kind of status or honor. The important thing, though, is that Theophilus. So the theo part means God, and the phile part means friend. So friend of God or lover of God. And the tendency is to think that this was a real person. You know, this was not an uncommon name. You know, for us it sounds like almost like a made-up name. Or did they really name people like that? Yes, they did. But also it could be, in a way, almost addressed to every Christian reader. That by addressing it to a friend of God or lover of God. So, for example, if you read St. Francis de Sales, The Introduction to the Devout Life. This is a book that our juniors read, usually second semester. They read about the first half of it, Francis de Sales' Introduction to the Devout Life. It's addressed to Philotheia. So it's reversed. It's addressed to Philotheia, friend of God. And there isn't a particular girl out there, Philotheia. It's addressed to every reader who is seeking to be a friend of God. Okay, it's addressed everywhere. So there's a way in which, yes, there's this particular person, but there's another way in which everybody who's seeking to grow to be a deeper friend of God, this book is for you. I wanted to end with a reflection of John Henry Cardinal Newman on Luke. This is a sermon that he gives on his feast day. Okay, there are a number of these sermons that he gives on feast days of the saints. So there's a St. Bartholomew and St. Barnabas. He has homilies for a lot of St. Matthew. There are a lot of these homilies he gives. And these are all homilies that are part of an 8-volume collection called the Parochial and Plain Sermons. I should write that down. If you go, they're all online. There's, in fact, a website called Newman Reader, which has all of his written works online. And I Parochial and Plain Sermons. Some of the most edifying things on Scripture, you know, I've read in Newman. And Newman is somebody I read and reread. You know, just read to the end, loop over, or start over again. Like I used to do with Lord of the Rings when I was in high school. And in these Parochial and Plain Sermons, these were sermons that he gave as an Anglican minister while he was at Oxford. He was the chaplain of St. Mary's at Oxford. But the thing about these sermons is they are not Anglican in the sense that they're somehow uniquely, you know, Church of England theology. If anything, what tends to nourish his outlook is the Church Fathers. That was Newman's formation. Newman was one of the early people to translate writers like Athanasius into English. There weren't just English translations of St. Athanasius around. Those early translations are by Newman. So it's nourished by this spirituality and faith life of the early church. That's what makes it really stand out. And a lot of the things that he argues are, quite frankly, Catholic. They would be just standard Catholic theology. So they're wonderful sermons. The reflection that he gives on Luke is titled "The Danger of Accomplishments." And he talks about Luke because this is obviously somebody who's educated. This is somebody who has all sorts of medical knowledge, and it's evident in his writing. This is evidently somebody who's a scholar. He knows how to take testimony and sift through it and now arrange and order it in a way that the reader is going to learn from that. So this is somebody that we would recognize as somebody who is educated, cultured, reflective, thoughtful. And so if you have this prejudice that somehow those things are harmful to the faith, that somehow that to be educated and to be cultured is somehow to diminish your Christianity, you know, Luke is a testimony against that. This really is an educated person. You can have the viewpoint that somehow to be simpler, to be less educated, that's what allows you to have faith. No, in the Catholic tradition, of course, we have these people who have brains coming out of their ears, you know, like a Thomas Aquinas, or think of all those great Jesuits like Suarez and Vasquez and so on. These are immensely bright people, but they're eventually devout people. They have a serious faith life. Nonetheless, Cardinal Newman makes the point that people have that point of view that somehow culture and education diminish faith, because very sadly, there are lots of people like that. there are lots of people for whom knowledge, scholarship, academics, grades, it somehow reduces the value of faith or the importance of faith and so on. And so what he talks about is to be cultured, to be educated, one of the most basic problems is that you start to cultivate emotion without action. So that's one of the basic problems about the more educated you are. In other words, you sit there and, let's say, read novels about people undergoing, let's say, great suffering or great passion or whatnot, and it's as if you're sort of vicariously enjoying what they do. But it's now disconnected to, am I feeling what I need to be feeling to live the way that I need to live? Okay. So when you read, for example, Augustine will talk about how it is that as a young man, he would go to the theater and there'd be all these great stories of lovers. You know, so think of like Romeo and Juliet. They're kind of versions of that. And he would weep with the lovers and, you know, and get all emotionally worked up. But he said, you know, what I wasn't thinking about is, hey, are these people really living a good life? Should I be really sympathetic to them? Is this a passion that's a self-destructive passion? Okay. The whole reason that we have emotions is so that we will be moved to do the things that we ought to do. That's why we have emotions. That's why they're there. I will tease the our sophomores. We get to units on, let's say, we're talking about poverty, you know, money, generosity. And so it could be that you're in your parish and, you know, you have these youth group things and confirmation, instruction. You're walking out of your parish and they have a poster up there for Catholic Relief Services. And there's this, you know, child starving in Africa. And you look at that and you think, wow, that's really sad that there are people starving. You know, all these other kids, they walk right up, they walk right past this poster, they didn't even notice it. But I care. That's why I look at this poster. I feel bad for that kid in that poster because I'm a caring person. It's the kind of person I am. And you walk away. You don't give anything to anybody. You don't volunteer for anything. You have just had a caring moment. Okay? You have just had a caring and empathetic moment. Okay? That is what Newman is describing by detaching emotion from action. Right? Whether it's movies, whether it's literature, whether it's various forms of studying history, there are all sorts of ways of working your emotions up, sort of elevating yourself above the scene, in which your emotions are now being detached from you doing what you need to do. Your emotions should be being assisted or helped to move toward the good. Whether that's generosity, whether that's forgiveness, whether that's loyalty, whether that's patience, whatever it is. Okay, so when we enjoy fictions, you know, there's this world in a way that we can create, and it's a comfortable world. And in a way, it doesn't make demands. That's the thing that's comfortable about it. But we need things that we read and study that convict us. I must admit, that's the experience that very often that I have when I read Newman's sermons. And he does it so gently. He will say, there is a kind of man who prays in such and such a way. And he thinks that God is working with him. But rather what he's doing is feeding his own pride. And so, and I'll read this description. Me! He's talking about me! Right? There'll be these ways in which he sets kind of moral or spiritual types. And you see yourself, as it were, in a mirror. And you realize, no, this is what I need to change. This is what I need to reform. Newman, for me, is wonderful about that. And again, he said he doesn't thump the pulpit, or he's not. It's not like sinners in the hands of an angry God. No, he just, in his very gentle but forceful way, holds up a kind of mirror to your soul and asks you, are you really, happy with it this way? No! So that's the thing that's wonderful about Newman. So when we see what we see in the example of St. Luke, this is somebody who really does have intellectual gifts, who really does have, in the 19th century sense of the word, accomplishments, who really does have culture and education, but has harnessed that ultimately for his spiritual and moral good. That what he understands about the world serves union with God and serves the mission of the gospel. Yes, those are our new bells. It almost sounds like a parody of a school, you know? Like you're imagining of what a school sounds like. Very good. So we're off and on our way. Next week, chapter 1 of the Gospel of Luke. Thank you.
Wow, what's he saying? Change the whole south.